You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Clap your hands.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 8:55 a.m. And it is, gosh, it's 7:01 in the morning on Thursday, the 9th of April. Now, we are just rocketing through this year, and it is, it's really been a full-on year so far. So I hope that you're all strapped in, taking care of yourselves, oxygen masks and all that. But also, you know, once you've put your own oxygen mask on, don't forget to reach out and help other people with theirs. Like, we all got to make this happen together. Now, we've got a packed show for you today, as always, starting off with a clip that we're going to be listening back to from International Women's Day. And this is Wiradjuri woman Kelly Flanagan, who spoke on IWD about the realities of the prison system. Now, Kelly's a survivor of intergenerational trauma, family violence, and of the prison system, and also a member of the Fig Jam Collective. And then after that, we are going to be joined in studio by comedian Demi Adejuyibe, who is also a director, musician, writer, and performer based in LA, joining us to discuss his Melbourne International Comedy Festival show, The Wheel. And after that, we are going to be joined by Dr. Alastair Sisson, who is speaking with us about a range of housing policy concerns, including the impact of supply chain disruptions on residential construction, and also calls for tax reform in the lead up to this year's federal budget. And finally, we will be joined by Jessica Harrison from the Australian Unemployed Workers Union and also co-presenter of 3CR's Breadline show to talk about the ongoing fight to abolish work for the dole leading up to the 10th anniversary of the tragic death of Josh Parkfing in April 2016. Now, there's going to be a rally, Justice for Josh, 10 years on, outside the office of Andrew Giles, MP, in Thomastown on Friday, the 17th of April from 1 to 2 p.m., and we will have information about how to register your attendance in our show notes. But stay tuned. We're going to be with you all the way through until 8:30 in the morning, and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 9th of April. Overnight, Israel launched a wave of bombings across 100 locations in Lebanon, displacing thousands, overwhelming hospitals with injured people, and killing hundreds of Lebanese people within the space of just 10 minutes. Iran has pushed for the ceasefire, announced this week with the United States to cover all fronts, including Lebanon, but Israel openly said yesterday that this would not be the case, and following up with what they refer to as Operation Eternal Darkness last night. The temporary so-called ceasefire in Iran follows genocidal threats by United States President Trump earlier this week that, quote, a whole civilization will die tonight, end quote, in reference to the Iranians, causing US lawmakers to call for him to be removed from office.
Also in news this week, former Australian soldier Ben Robert Smith has been arrested over alleged war crimes in Afghanistan, with charges expected to include 5 counts of murder linked to the killing of civilians and detainees. The arrest follows a years-long investigation stemming from the Brereton Report, which uncovered evidence of unlawful killings and systemic cover-ups by special forces. The arrest of Robert Smith marks a critical step towards justice, and rights advocates are urging authorities to fully pursue accountability and implement the inquiry's recommendations.
In other news, the federal government's plan to make slowly growing in the NDIS National Disability Insurance Scheme a central part of its upcoming budget saving strategy. In response, the peak body for disability services is urging providers to participate in public debate about the future of the scheme, saying that the NDIS has enough funding but is riddled with the integrity failures. The government aims to reduce NDIS growth to 5 to 6% or lower. Currently, the NDIS is one of the country's largest social programs, supporting thousands of people with disability. The government's plans come amidst recent reports of fraud that have been prompted calls for stronger regulation and transparency of NDIS providers. But Avakin warns reductions and enforcement policies should consider disproportionate impacts on some communities.
Also in headlines this week, Meta and TikTok have been accused of censoring life-saving drug harm reduction content after posts and accounts from groups like Pill Testing Australia were removed or suspended. Australian Injecting and Illicit Drug Users League warns the takedowns are dangerous as they block critical public health alerts about toxic drug supplies and urge regulators to force the platforms to restore content and improve moderation systems.
In other news, the National Tertiary Education Union has accused the Victorian universities of abusing Freedom of Information Act processes to conceal executive salaries and contracts with fossil fuels and weapons companies. A union report found widespread delays, with requests taking far longer than the legally required 30 days, refusals and heavy reductions, raising concerns about transparency and prompting calls for Freedom of Information law reform.
And finally in headlines this week, a case with major implications for whistleblowing and press freedom is set to go before the High Court this month. This case centres on footage of alleged animal cruelty filmed by activists at a Victorian abattoir that was later shared with regulators and the media. A federal court ruling found the activists did not own copyright to the footage and must hand it over and delete it, marking an unprecedented legal development. The organizations argue the decision could undermine public interest journalism by allowing wrongdoing to be concealed under this kind of decision. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 9th of April, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
War or public housing? Resist the push to defund essential services. Increasing militarisation and drive to war around the world is taking public money away from essential government spending on things like public housing, education, aged care, childcare and health. On Thursday, 16th of April at 6 p.m, come and hear from speakers on how we can resist the push to become a weapons economy and instead fund essential public services. Blue Room, City of Melbourne's multicultural hub. For more information and to RSVP for your free ticket, please visit the Save Public Housing Collective on Facebook or Instagram. A 3CR supporter.
You're tuned into Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:09 in the morning. Wild weather today. I think this might be one of the last warm days for a while, but it's a weird warm day. Stormy. There's going to be rain on and off. It's very humid. I'm feeling sweaty. It's uncomfortable. And we're going to go into our first segment for today. Now, just a content warning for listeners. This is a clip from IWD, and it does include some discussion of sexual violence in the prison system. So for mob that are listening, if you need to speak to anyone, you can call 13YARN on 139276. And also anybody listening, if you need to speak to somebody, you can call the suicide callback service on 1-300-659-467. Now, we are going to listen to a speech from International Women's Day from Kelly Flanagan, a Wiradjuri woman and survivor of intergenerational trauma, family violence, and the prison system, and a member of the collective FIGJAM, or Formerly Incarcerated Girls Justice Advocates Melbourne.
Here's Kelly Flanagan. So Kelly is a Wiradjuri woman and a survivor of intergenerational trauma, family violence, and the prison system. She's a member of the collective FIGJAM, Formerly Incarcerated Girls Justice Advocates Melbourne. Radical women met Kelly through her campaigning to expose the use of lockdowns at De Mohilis Frost Correction Centre and more generally strip searches as sexual assaults. Kelly openly challenges the systemic violence which impacts First Nations women most through her art, writing and speaking, documenting, as she says, the realities of imprisonment, survival, and life beyond the system. Thank you, Rich.
Thank you so much for having me today. My name is Kelly Flanagan, a proud Wiradjuri woman. I am also formerly incarcerated, and I come to you today, you know, gracefully to share my story about what the system has done to me, the effects of that, and the, you know, the ongoing flow of that, you know, into my family, my daughter. And so I guess my story started at a very young age. I started using drugs due to having a racist parent, having a black mom and a white dad. And so it really created some issues for me growing up around who I am, what I am, and where I fit. So obviously drug use for me was natural. Now the reason I want to start on that is because that pretty much set the whole way for me for prison. I was in a violent relationship and was being very controlled, and I'd reached out to the police before to get some help and misidentified as the traitor and not the victim. And so that just started my whole prison journey. I was in need of help and I got completely the opposite. So I was arrested and taken to prison for violent-related offences. While I was being arrested, or while the police came in, they threw my daughter to the ground, and then I spent the next 3.5 years in prison. I would like to tell you that I come out of prison like rehabilitated. That's just not true. The truth is that while I was in there, I was yet again, you know, at the hands of the system. I was strip searched. Now, I want to explain to you strip searching, right? Because strip searching is not strip searching, it's sexual assault. Because I've been sexually violated, I've been raped before, and I'm telling you, it feels exactly the same. And I want to share that with you because the importance of challenging those terms, you know, in that patriarchal, you know, not strip searching, it never has been, it's always been sexual assault. And so what we do is we're speaking about that and calling it what it is. I've had threats from the prison that I need to keep my mouth shut about some of the stuff that happens in there. Like, I don't care. I will speak what I need to say. I am brutal about it, and I don't care because there's women that are still in there that are, like, suffering, you know, getting taken into small rooms by male officers, being strip searched, being laughed at. I know I was body shamed. I had my period. I had to remove the sanitary items and hand them to the officers, bend and part, and squat. And this isn't just one time. This is a lot of times. Like, we're talking regularly in the prison, the female officers that were searching me. And so I also feel that being in a dominant male sort of work environment, these women have also taken on that. They've taken on that behaviors because they work in that field. Now, I'm not saying everyone is like this. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying my experience is this. So there might be some great people in that industry, but I haven't, you know, met them. And then we had the lockdowns. So I got out of prison March last year. We had a rally in June. I come out so angry and so broken because on top of all of these other things, what I'd experienced was severe lockdowns. So what that means is normally you would stay in your cell for a period of the day. You'd get out about 8 o'clock in the morning. You'd be free to, you know, go to school or education, work, whatever it is, until about 7 o'clock, and then you get locked back down again to the next day. But what they were actually doing is they were locking us down for 3 and 4 days at a time without any fresh air. So on occasions, there was time we went without food. There was times that we weren't allowed to see our lawyer,
certainly weren't able to use the phone because the phone was outside of the cell, so you couldn't use it for days at a time. I got out, we set up a rally out front of Corrections Victoria in Exhibition Street. We shut down the whole block. We had to come out, so they locked down the whole block. And then we marched through, you know, through Melbourne, down to the gardens. Something left me at that moment because I felt like I wasn't doing enough. I had like that survivor's guilt, you know. I got out and all these other girls are still there, and it's. So I cried after that, and then it was like I got to breathe for a couple months, but then the fire came back and I just wanted to do some more work in that space. So what we've recently done is we have launched the Ending Strip Searching Report, and we've done that alongside Flat Out and the Human Rights Law Centre. It was such an honour to release it. You know, after spending that period of time in prison, you get comments like, you know, you'll never amount to anything now that you've been to prison. You, on the way out, we'll see you in a few weeks, or we'll see you in a few months, you know. And so with the strip searching report, I guess what I really want to touch on is that, you know, we're doing a petition, we're doing all the things that we need to be doing, but the next step is taking it to court and see if we can get some outcomes that way to make sure that it doesn't happen anymore. And we've got stories from up to, there's 13 girls that have been through it, who have recently been released, and we've all gathered together to be able to share our stories, because they can argue maybe with one of us, but they can't argue with 13 of us saying the same thing happened. So it's very interesting for us to be able to go up against the system, because it hasn't been done before, right? It hasn't been, we've been threatened, like I said, to stop talking, to stop making noise, and there's been situations where some of the girls are on parole still, so they're going to these parole appointments and they have like this patriarchal built system, you know, threatened to take their freedoms away because they want to speak up about. Coming together in a space like this gives me the ability to share vulnerably to you so that you can understand and go and have these conversations with other people. Because when you look at taking a woman, right, off away, you take away a mother, you take away a sister, a daughter, an auntie. But when you take that mother away, what happens is you now are affecting the whole family. You're affecting everybody. And so for me, having my daughter was 16 when I was taken to prison, she's never been the same again, right? And so these are the kind of things that we need to start looking at. The policing system is garbage. It's absolute garbage. What do we need to do? I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out, right? I haven't been around for it for a while, but surely with all of the beautiful faces in this room and the minds in this room, we can talk about what that looks like, because I feel like moving forward, if we say enough's enough and we action it, we have to make some change in that space. I came out when radical women were supporting me when I came out of prison, and we did the rally, and I remember Deb coming up to me and having a conversation with me about, you know, we've got you, and it just really inspired me to go, Deb doesn't know me from a bar of soap, right? She gets out, puts her love in me, and for me that was like, that's what I needed. I needed that love, that care, and that compassion. And so I hadn't had that for so long, for nearly 3.5 years. And to have a complete stranger come up to me and give me that was like nothing I'd ever felt. I guess because that's why I'm here today, right? Because it's like, if I can get that little bit of glimmer from Deb just in that few minutes that I spent with her, maybe working together, what can we achieve, you know, in this room today? So thank you all for listening. And I appreciate you all coming today.
That was the brilliant Kelly Flanagan, Rajuri woman and survivor of intergenerational trauma, family violence, and the prison system, and a member of the collective Fig Jam, formerly Incarcerated Girls Justice Advocates Melbourne. And she was speaking at International Women's Day about the realities of the prison system, as well as survival and life beyond it. Now, if you did want to speak to anybody about some of the themes that came up in that interview, acknowledging there was some discussion of sexual violence and just the violence of the prison system, mob can call 13YARN, that is 139276. And there's also the suicide callback service on 1-300-659-467. And then also, if you are needing support around domestic and family violence, or you want to talk to somebody about those issues, you can call 1-800-RESPECT. That is 1-800-737-732. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:20 in the morning.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from so-called Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio 855 AM or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Woo! Woo!
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. And before we continue with the rest of our segments, I just wanted to really platform to bring people to the coronial inquest into the death in custody of Noongar man Geoffrey Winmar. It's really, really, really important for people to show up in person because this place is so unsafe for mob and the family during an already incredibly devastating time. Having to look at the justice system and hear these gross evidences from lawyers and policemen who are trying to obfuscate responsibility and getting, you know, certificates for impunity, like being able to be there not only bears witness to what is happening and the process, but also provides such important solidarity with the family during an unimaginable loss. So please show up, please bring people and share with others who can attend. The inquest is concluding tomorrow at Friday the 10th of April. So you can attend today from 10 a.m. and tomorrow from 10 a.m. at the Coroner's Court of Victoria, 65 Kavanagh Street, South Bank. You can also join by WebEx link if you aren't able to attend in person, and that's really important too. So yeah, you can also look up these details on the Darjoa Foundation website and their Instagram as well.
Yes, and that Instagram handle is at Darjoa underscore foundation, DHADJOWA underscore foundation. And also just wanted to shout out the incredible work of the Darjoa Foundation and folks volunteering there who have been providing daily recaps of the inquest. So on their Instagram account, you can also go through and read what's been happening during the inquest and see why it is so important to show up. So please do show up if you're able. Again, that is from 10 a.m. at the Coroner's Court of Victoria, South Bank, 65 Kavanagh Street, South Bank. All of our solidarity and love to the family and loved ones of Geoffrey Winmar, who are going through this incredibly traumatic process.
Tune in to Stick Together, all about workers' rights and social justice.
8:30 a.m. Wednesday, 7 a.m. Saturday.
Or listen on demand on 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au.
Hey, hey.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
VCR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast, and now we have a very special guest joining us in the studio, Demi Adejuwebe, who is a director, comedian, musician, writer, performer based in LA, joining us to discuss his Melbourne International Comedy Festival show, The Wheel, that's on now, and hot off the heels of his award-nominated special, Demi Adejuwebe is going to do one backflip. Thanks so much for joining us here.
Thank you so much for having me. What a joy to be here.
I am, just so thankful that you responded to the email straight away, and it was very...
I don't get a lot of emails of people asking me to do stuff. Everyone's like, oh, he's not going to... I'm like, I'm on my phone 24-7. When I respond late, it's because I'm anxious about an email, but yeah. I'm happy you reached out.
Yeah. How's your time in NAM or Melbourne been so far?
It's been lovely. My show is so late in the day that so much of my time is just kind of... riding a bike around and taking photos and then eating good food, but it's lovely. I really enjoy it here. It's why I came back.
Yeah, we have such great food here.
Yes. I posted a photo of a meal I had the other day, and all of the responses were just like, don't post food that looks this good again. I'm like, I didn't understand that people would be upset about it. But yeah.
Well, I know that you're here for the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, mm-hmm. debuting your brand new show, The Wheel.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting name. Can you tell us more about the show and why it's called that?
I can't tell. But honestly, the thing is, so basically, I designed a show with the intention of wanting to come back to Melbourne. And I agreed to do the show before I even had the show finished. And so they were like, well, what's the title going to be? And initially, I had an idea for a show where I wanted to bring a big wheel that I spun around. I made the audience spin around. And it's like, okay, every 4 minutes, I'm going to do a new bit off the wheel. And it was going to be silly things where one idea was like substitute teacher hour, where it's like, okay, for the next 4 minutes, I'm just going to play a movie and leave the stage. And I didn't end up doing that because I was like, that's a little silly, and I think the audience will get frustrated if we're spinning the same stuff over and over. But by that point, I had submitted the name already. Yep. So it's called The Wheel, and I've not figured a reason to explain that.
That's cool.
Yeah.
What can people expect coming in if they haven't seen some of your work before?
I think, so this show is a lot of songs. I feel like I end up writing... I think a lot of my comedy online has been very music-based in that I will write a song that's like a sort of fake summary of something, or it's just like a fake pastiche of some sort of style. And in trying to make this show, I really realized that what excited me the most was writing comedy songs. And so I brought a couple instruments. I'm going to be playing them live, and it's just a lot of me trying to write a song that's like, oh, this is, I wanted to make a Halloween novelty hit, or I wanted to make a Christmas hit, or I wanted to make a fake country song. And so it's a lot of stuff like that. And then in between that, it's little bits where it's like there's a thing, a recurring thing throughout the show where I tell jokes that are really not anything more than just what I've written down on a card, and it's not, doesn't go more than that. There's a magic trick in the show.
Amazing.
There is a fake audition sequence. I think I was just sort of like, what makes me laugh? What makes my friends laugh when we're riffing? And I turn those into bits.
Amazing. Yeah, I think that really comes through in so much of your work. Mm-hmm. And I know that I've been following your brilliant work for a long time such a fan person. And I know that you've been doing stand-up, you've been doing writing, you're doing ensemble work, and your incredible Letterboxd reviews.
Oh, thank you.
I'm curious what it's been like being a public figure, I guess, for so long, and you have so much of your work out there. Does that like impact how your audiences relate to you?
I think it does, in that it's sort of like people getting to understand what I do more and more the more stuff I do, which sometimes makes me feel a little like, oh, they're learning the pattern, and then it makes me want to switch up the pattern where it's like, oh, I've done too much of this. I'm going to stop that. I want to do something like this instead. But I think I'm just very lucky that I have an audience that's willing to return and come back and see stuff. I think that I also am lucky enough that every time I do a show, people are like, oh, I loved you in this. And it's always something different. It's not just like, I loved this one thing that you've done, which is always so flattering. And when people mention my Letterboxd, I'm like, that's crazy, because that's just writing. Yeah, and sometimes it's writing that gets me into trouble.
Yeah.
But I just feel very fortunate that the internet's given me a platform to do all sorts of different things, but also all sorts of different things that reach people all over the world. Like, I couldn't come to Melbourne if it wasn't for just a platform online that allows me to write stuff that people from Melbourne can see.
Yeah,
or, like, perform on a platform like Dropout that people can see.
Yeah. Are you ever surprised by what people, like, recognize you for or connect with you for your work?
Oh, yeah.
You said, like, your Letterboxd reviews, but is it some of your other work where you're like, oh, I thought I was really killing it here, and I'm killing it here too, but maybe I didn't realize that this resonated so much with
Yeah, I wish I could remember what it was. I did a show in LA, I want to say 2 months ago, and someone afterwards was just like, by the way, I'm such a big fan, I've been following you since, and they mentioned something that I had even forgot about, where I was like, what? I didn't know that was still online. And that's always very fascinating and exciting, but it also means that I get to connect with people and not just feel like how like a famous actor will probably be like, yeah, you've seen that movie, you've seen that, whatever. But it always just feels like, oh, it's a surprise. And then I get to talk about a thing because I'm lucky enough that a lot of the stuff I've done online is just made from pure creation of, I enjoy this thing. So it's not work where I'm like, yeah, I had to do that movie and people want to talk to me about it. It's like, people are like, oh, I love this podcast. I'm like, I loved it too. Wait, let's talk about it. Or I'll just be like, oh, I wish I could still do that, but it took up so much time. And I'm just very fortunate. I feel extremely privileged that so much of my work has just been something that I did and that people really cottoned to. It's not something that, like, I had to do.
Yeah. And that really comes through in so much of your work, where you can tell you're just having so much fun. It's really subversive and, yeah, just beautiful.
Thank you.
And I know some of our listeners may be hearing of you for the first time. So to introduce them to more of your work, your latest debut special, Debbie Adejuyibe, is going to do one backflip.
Mm-hmm.
And your love of film and comedy. I know Ocean's 11 is one of your favorite movies.
It sure is.
And same here. There's nothing more that I love that more than a heist movie. I, first time alone, spent New Year's Eve alone.
Mm-hmm.
And then all I did was watch the Ocean's trilogy. And I think that's
great,
the perfect
way to, yeah.
New Year's Eve bringing in the new year. But how do you think preparing and performing your latest special felt similar to Ocean's 11? Like, what had to take place for it to all come together?
You couldn't have asked me a better question. I'll talk about this movie until they take away your radio license. It's so, it's one of my favorite things. And I do think it is, like, one of the most inspirational pieces of work to me. Because I remember being a kid and just watching that movie, and just every time the ending came, I'd be like, it's almost like I am seeing it for the first time. I was like, how'd they do that? And it's a movie that makes you want to watch it again.
Yes.
And I think that my show is a lot like that, in that I want to make something that you have one experience watching it the first time, and then the second time you see the dominoes getting set up, you see the pieces. Because I think that storytelling, when it comes especially to heist films and to con movies, is very special. It's directing like a magic trick. It's manipulation. It's, you know, that the three card Monty where you think you're watching one thing and then they reveal it's something else. And that is something that I really love, because it makes the audience lean in. It's them going, I'm going to figure this out. So they're like paying attention. And then I go, you thought you figured it out, it's actually this thing. And I think that in doing this show, it does feel like putting together a team where I'm like, okay, I have these instruments that set up one thing. I have this robot that sets up another thing. I have this thing. I have this thing. I have this thing. And I want it to sort of feel like no one really knows what's coming next. And then at the end, there's a big reveal that feels like, oh, I thought that was a mistake, and actually it's not. And that's always so fun to me because I think it just... It shows not only how clever I am, but it also just it sort of takes to task the idea of like things that you see in a comedy show that you think are a mistake, and therefore it's like I do have a little bit of leeway when I make a mistake because people are like, well, how much of that was real and how much of it wasn't? And it's so fun to me to do that because I don't know, it's like watching a magic trick. It always just turns you into a kid. It makes you feel like what do you mean? What is this world? And I think it's just such a fun feeling. And I think that. The feeling of putting together a heist is exactly how I go into every new show, where I'm not just going, I want to tell a joke. I'm going, I want to trick the audience. I want to manipulate them in a way that is fun. I want to recreationally gaslight the audience.
That makes it, I think that's what a heist is. It's for the good of the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
And from like the first few days where you did it at, I think it was, what is it, Edinburgh Fringe? Mm-hmm. How did it evolve from that when you're like rehearsing for the Fringe Festival to when it becomes like a dropout special?
Right.
How does it change?
One of the big things for me is whenever I perform something in front of an audience, it's just a lot of testing out and going like, what works outside of my brain? What references hit with other people? What is surprisingly a bigger laugh than I think? That's always a thing where I'm like, oh, I thought that was a minor joke and everyone loves it.
Yep.
And then also a lot of it when I get to do it out of the country is what works outside of America, which has also been fun to test here because there are some things where I'm like, and people are like, huh. And then there's some things where I'm just like, what? Why are people reacting to that? And it's like, well, because it's here, that means something else. And that's always so fun. But also just getting to like work on it in a way where I'm having to go, you have an hour. So you have to cut stuff down. You have to make stuff clearer. You have to kill a few of your darlings. When I did the last show, there was a song or two that I'd cut and like some bits that I was like, that's fun. But my directors were just kind of like, I don't think that it fits with the theme of the show necessarily. So we had to excise it. And I got to bring one of those back for this show, which is very exciting. But it also just means that there's always an attempt to make it tighter and make it okay, I need to find a through line here. It can't just be bit. I need to figure out what the connecting tissue is here. Which, funny enough, with this show is something I'm still trying to figure out because I truly was just like, I just want to perform in the festival again. So It does feel like a classic, like, I'm just working stuff out. But it's all very polished. It just doesn't feel like a one-man show. It's just sort of like, here's some jokes.
Yeah.
But I'm very fortunate that I get to do something like a festival where I play to new audiences, and a lot of times it's also getting to play to audiences that don't know me. When you're doing more than like two shows, a lot of people just show up being like, I heard this was good, or it was happening at this time, let's see what it is. And then I get to play to people who aren't familiar with my sensibility and get to see like what it means to them or if it hits with them, because sometimes they'll just be like, no, I don't know what this is, I'm not online enough, and I'm like, okay, that means I have to change some of it.
Yeah.
But it's always so exciting.
Yeah, of course. I don't want to spoil the special, so I want everybody to please go watch it on Dropout. But you're rehearsing to do the backflip, And I'm just wondering what that means to think about doing a backflip every single show, what it means for the venue managers, for the insurance, for your body.
It means less than you think. A lot of people are just sort of like, it's probably got it.
Okay, really?
I think a backflip is one of those things that rides the line perfectly of like, it is theoretically dangerous, but more people than you think can do it, and a lot of people do it. And also, it's the kind of thing that, like, no one's going to promise they're going to do it unless it's something they feel like they can do. So there was never any point where a venue was truly just like, and safety precautions. They were just like, probably got it. I've seen children do this. Probably got it. Which is very fortunate for me, given how the backflip actually plays out. But was very funny the first time I did the show in London, where the backflip happened in a way where I had to change it. The biggest threat was to my body and me going, I can't necessarily do a good backflip, but I want to figure it out and try. And it's funny because the first time I did the show, I was 27.
Yep.
And by the time I was like shooting the special, I was 32. And I was like, oh, that's 5 years and I'm into my 30s. My body is not the same as it was. I wake up and my bones are cracking. I'm like, this is definitely a different show than it was when I was 27. And just hubris was motivating me in everything I do. So it became more of a challenging thing, but I think that made the show better.
Yeah, definitely. I think being able to, you kind of have that through line throughout the entire special, like, are you going to do the backflip? Mm-hmm. But it's really exciting. I was just wondering when you kind of decide to be like, I can't keep doing the, incorporating the backflip as it is in the first way, because that's like 5 years that you've been running the show. Mm-hmm. What does it kind of change for the show?
Well, so when I went to, I did the show in London, I want to say March of 2024, and it was the first time in a few years, and the first time that I was doing it outside of the country, and it was me testing certain things, and I walked into the room where I was doing the venue I was performing in, and I was just sort of like, wow, the ceiling here is really low, like I can touch it, and I'm very short for people listening at home. Imagine a small man.
People have seen me before.
Yes, imagine someone in Nez's height.
Yeah.
And so I was just like, that's weird. And the venue was like, well, if you feel nervous about it, you can just practice the backflip ahead of time. And all the like venue staff was there, and I was like, great, I'll just do it right now. And I did it, and they were all just like, that's not as smooth as we thought. And I did it three times, and my directors were just like, yeah, you're not doing this anymore. We're not comfortable with you doing it in this room, in this space. And it was like that night we were like, we need to figure out a new ending. We don't know why, but it's not working. We need to figure out something new. And in the process of them forcing me to do that, it really changed the show for the better, because I was like, well, then what am I if I don't have this big stunt as a way to draw people in? Like, the whole point is me going, I'm promising you something big because you want to see, like, can he really do it? And I think that made the show, that broke it open, was like, well, why do you feel the need to have a big stunt? What's that about? And that sort of crystallized the theme of the show. So I was very lucky that I got to do it even before I crystallized the theme of the show. And it was like this, from that point on, we were like, this is an Evel Knievel show. This is something that you are promising one big stunt, and then you're wasting an hour building up to it.
Yep.
And in the process of doing so, we realized it's more fun to make people realize they don't want to see the stunt. Because it's like, at a certain point, you're just like, yeah, I guess if he's done this several times, I bet he can do the backflip. And then going, oh, wait a minute. Hey, I don't want you to see. I'm actually really worried about this now. It's so much more of a more fun way to con the audience. It's the Ocean's 11 of going like, I wanted you to expect this one thing, and now I want you to realize that you don't want that thing at all. So then when I do it, you're like, oh, God, wait, this is worse than I thought. And then give you a little bit of a catharsis. But yeah.
It's amazing. And speaking of the catharsis for the newest special, mm-hmm. I know that the special is really alternative and subversive, and it's presented by Dropout, mm-hmm. an independent comedy streaming service that is funded by the subscribers, and also really focuses on like residuals and collaboration between artists and being an independent radio station at 3CR.
Right.
I'm wondering what it's meant for you to be part of Dropout and really, you know, build something independent and special with them.
It's phenomenal, and I did not ever imagine, especially, well, I feel very lucky to be in the Dropout universe just because it's something that people feel such a direct connection to, and it is one of the things in my career that's been the biggest boon for me, but also just, like, I say a lot of times that when I'm doing a Dropout show, I still feel like a Make-A-Wish kid. Like, I'm just like, I can't believe they let me do this. Like, it feels like it's my last wish or something, because I'm just messing around with friends, and I'm having such a good time, and it's very playful. But still structured, and still, I think because they've made their public image about how fair and like how important it is that is the biggest thing, that it means that they can't prioritize profit over that. They're really focused on people coming to the shows and feeling like we are not getting like screwed over, which is lovely. But in working with them in more specific stuff like my special, I realized that one of the benefits of them being independent is that they don't have people sort of beating down the door to be like, hey, you probably shouldn't do that. It's like all just, and so much of my show is like, honestly, a legal nightmare where it's like, oh, you have to clear images of Marge Simpson. You have to clear the voice of Barack Obama. Stuff where it's like, I'm sure any major network would be like, you can't do that. You can't use that. And Dropout didn't blink once. They were just sort of like, great, we'll figure this out. We'll figure out what fair use is. We'll like cut stuff down. They were like, rewrite this bit, but not in a way where it's like we're trying to censor you, but in a way where it's like, we don't want Billy Joel to come after us and stuff like that. And which I found very lovely to work with them on that. And also, they're throughout every single time I did my show, there was a thing at at the end where I get a call from Barack Obama and then eventually ask him why he hasn't said anything about Palestine. And then the call just cuts out as a joke. And I was like, they're going to make me cut that. And not once they mentioned it, they didn't cut it. They let me say it. The audience always applauds and it's in the special. And I was just like, oh, they didn't bat an eye. They're just like, yeah, why not? Like that was never a conversation. And so I feel very honored that a network like that allows me to speak my mind and say things that I'm like, well, personally, I believe this. And I'm frustrated that this is something the president never talked about. But I also was like, this is a dig that I think some people would be upset about, and I've gotten no pushback, nothing about it. And I think that's because they're like, we don't care about ruffling any feathers. Like, this is your special. Do what you want. And that's just so awesome that to be able to say something like that on a platform where you know that people are on your side about it, but also the network is not interested in censoring you in any way.
Yeah, that's if you hear that, Priya, as well. Like, I feel so strongly that 3CR is so similar, where you don't feel censored, you can actually say what you want, particularly with things like Palestine. And we've coming up to our 50-year anniversary.
50 years.
I know.
Wow.
Yeah.
You tell?
Yeah, it's old. Yeah.
It's fun. But yeah, how do you feel, I guess, hearing that, Priya?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that's something that is really beautiful about comedy, where you are able to really be authentic and honest, because then you get to tap into the sentiment of the audience, who it also feels like it takes a load off people's shoulders when you're able to crack a joke that then taps into how people really feel
Absolutely,
about the world,
yeah.
right? Yeah. And you've also given me a dangerous sense of confidence about practicing backflips.
Do it.
Oh, my God.
Do it.
I was thinking, you know, you mentioned at the top that you've been riding a bike around, mm-hmm. and as somebody who rides a bike everywhere myself, I'm thinking maybe that's the hook for the wheel.
Oh, that the wheel is the bike wheel.
Maybe the wheel's the bike wheel.
Yeah,
I don't know.
The wheel of fortune wheel. We're just listing off all the
different
all
types of wheels. There was a version of my backflip show that I did in Edinburgh where I got very cocky and was like, I'm sort of in a loop with this. I've sort of got it memorized. People are enjoying the show. It's getting good reviews. I should make it a little crazier. And I did one show on roller skates. And I keep being like, maybe I bring it back and I do this show on roller skates and that's the wheel. But I was like, what I realized with that show is it's like, okay, well, now I've just added a complicated thing to this and it's not impressive. People are just like, why are you doing that? So I took the skates off halfway through and I'm like, it is something that I'm just like, maybe I bring it back at some point in this show somehow. Maybe that's the wheel.
Yeah. Well, like I also just I was thinking about the backflip as well. And I do love the device where you have something there, you know, at the end. It's this heist thing where the audience at the end finds out, oh, actually, this was intentional all along. This thing is meant to be on stage. And it is like a great trick to hook people into listening intentionally, waiting for the thing. Although it doesn't always have to be a backflip.
No, I think I learned last time that it probably shouldn't be a backflip ever again, but I am always in search of what that thing is. And there's something in my show that is like that, but you sort of think that it's not happening. So then people don't lean in there. So I'm trying to think of what the theme is, but I don't know. I'm just having fun performing the show. And I think last time I got lucky and just found a theme along the way, and that's probably going to happen this time too. But there's no big stunt for me to learn about, so I'm like, we'll see what it is that I discover in making this show.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm also kind of wondering about, you know, how long are you here?
I'm here for a month.
Okay, well, there's plenty of, I think, like bespoke Australian stunts you could learn in that time, you know, maybe for the next thing.
Yeah.
What are the Australian stunts? Shooey?
Yeah, you
don't do that. Don't do that.
I mean, you could do a shooey.
I can't do. The thing is, the problem is I brought boots that I wear everywhere. And so everyone's like, you can do a shooey on the go. And I'm like, but I've been wearing these boots and I know how stink they are.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it.
Yeah. If I feel like you kind of, you know, I personally wouldn't do a shooey out of my own shoe, but I would bring a prop shoe.
Oh, that's smart. Yes. Yeah. A perfectly new unwrapped shoe.
Yeah. You could
eat fairy bread.
Oh, yeah. Have you eaten fairy bread? What is
that?
Know about fairy bread?
No.
It sounds magical because it is.
Yes.
It's plain white bread, the like cheapest, like worst white bread that you can find sliced. And then you put, I think it's margarine typically, not butter, and then sprinkles.
Yeah. Oh. But they have to be little circular sprinkles.
They're called hundreds and thousands.
That sounds great.
This is such a typical, like, this international guest comes to, like, radio.
Have fairy about fairy bread. You got to go to the football. Like,
got to do shooey. Yeah.
I actually did go to an AFL match last time I was here, and I really enjoyed it, and I might go again this year. And it's fun because I don't think I ever understood the rules, but I still got very into it and was, like, cheering whenever a team made a point. And I was just like, yeah, this is great. You get really swept up in the fervor of it.
I don't understand AFL. I've always followed football, soccer, but Ado Priya is the biggest fan of AFL.
Who's your team?
The Brisbane Lions.
Okay.
We won the grand final for the past 2 years.
Oh, just nothing. So just a little
congrats.
Bit of nothing.
Like, just whatever. It's probably got nothing to do with
my friend last night was talking about how her team is Carlton, and she's like, and they're just awful. They're just not doing it. I'm like, that's so funny to just be like, I will stand by this team through everything, and everything for them is a lot of nothing.
Yeah. No, I feel... I really feel for a lot of the fandoms that are, you know, they like bring their kids up in the fandom and they're like, you're never going to see us like, do well.
But that means when they finally do, you've earned it. So it's like being a White Sox fan in America. I'd really just like, I think it's that. So none of us know.
Hey, who knows?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. You could say anything about America and we'd be like, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I would be
I
like,
believe
probably.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think following something that is so special and beautiful just for you just really makes it so much more special.
Yeah.
I guess while you're here, how are you either like just like moving through the show? Like, do you think it'll be different every night? And also, like, what are you planning to do when you're here? Are you more spontaneous? Do you plan stuff out, things you want to do?
I don't plan things out too much, aside from like when friends are like, we're going to this, or I want you to do this show or whatnot. In terms of the show itself, I find that I get very, not bored, but I just like, when I'm locked into something, it's not as exciting for me. And so I find that throughout doing a show, especially when I'm doing it for like 2 weeks like I am here, I end up changing little things here and there, or being like, you know what would be fun is adding this element. Like last minute for my first two shows, I added a thing where I was like, there's this recurring segment through the show where I was just like, I feel like these jokes, people have been telling me, like, you're going to want to throw a tomato at me. And so I taped a tomato under one special seat. And I tell people, like, if you got that tomato, you have one moment in the show where you're allowed to throw a tomato at me if a joke is so bad. And it's been so funny because it puts the a moment of comedy in the audience's hands, and it always kills. And yesterday, so two nights ago, they sort of were like, gave me a warning, then threw it and missed. And then last night, it just, in the middle of a joke, just like hit me square in the chest and was such a big laugh, but I didn't see it coming. And it is just like... fun because it puts me on my toes and makes it feel very interactive, and it's like, oh, this isn't rehearsed, that's a real person that just threw a tomato at him, and it's so fun. And I like that kind of stuff, so I'm like trying to figure out what more things, and it really is like, that is kind of what the wheel as an idea was, where I'm like, it's sporadic, I want it to be like some things are rehearsed, but altogether you guys are making this show. And I'm like, I've had a lot of fun taping things under people's chairs, so I'm like, what else could I do? Like, maybe I give someone a whistle where they're just like, that's not a good joke, or like, I have a better punchline or something like that. But it's figuring out what makes it feel more alive, that allows me to feel like, oh, this is not just a show that I'm putting on, but a show that an audience feels engaged in.
Yeah. And then what are you doing, I guess, after like a show? Because it must be so strenuous on your body and your mind, or obviously fun, but like afterwards you're like, oh, I just want to collapse. You're like, no, I'm energized, I want to keep going.
My problem is that the show is very stressful for me in like the 3 hours leading up to it, because there's a lot of moving pieces and I'm always afraid that I'm going to forget some. The first night I did. But I, because of that, it's like I live in the anxiety of it. And then the show happens and I just have all this adrenaline of like that I'm trying to keep up. So my show ends at like 10 o'clock and I'm just still wired. And I am just like, well, it's too, like, there's no other show after that. There's really nothing to go and do after that. So it is just sort of like, well, I guess I'll go back, or I'll see if a friend wants to go for a walk, or I'll get a late night dinner or something. But it's hard. I'm hoping that as the festival progresses, I have less of that stress and can go see other shows before mine, because I feel like that's the worst part about doing a festival, is you don't get to see a lot of the other performers. But ultimately, I think I'm still in the mode of trying to figure out what I do after a show, as opposed to just falling asleep.
That is the time where you want to jump on a bike and just like whiz around.
Oh,
and highly, highly recommend.
Yeah, are there any nice spots, do you think, to bike around? Botanical Gardens, but you can't really bike around
there. Well, you can't really bike around there, but there is like the main Yarra Trail, which will take you along the river. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you want to, if you're after the show, you message a friend, nobody's gotten back to you, you're like,
trying to bike around.
You've already eaten something, get on the bike.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's been such a joy. I'm trying not to be like, woohoo.
No, let's
do it.
That's how we start the morning.
I think, yeah, just knowing that someone else loves heist movies as much as I do, because I will literally talk about that all the time. And I'm always thinking about how can we bring the principles of a heist into everything that we do.
Yeah.
We do it to community radio when we have to organize a show every week. Mm-hmm. Yes. But also when you're like trying to organize a project. But sometimes I'll be at work and I'm like, right now I'm George Clooney.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I'm like sending an email.
You gotta figure out how to channel that energy into stuff and make it exciting for you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it also came from like being a theater kid younger as well and being like putting on a suit and sunglasses, pretending to be like smoking a cigarette, but really it's just like a little crayon, and I'm like blowing bubbles out of it.
Oh my God.
Like, I'm so mysterious, you have no idea.
R.I.P. our family's Reservoir Dogs production.
Wait, that you did that? That's incredible. Who were you in Reservoir Dogs?
I was the Bat, which
the Bat,
a character that was not actually in Reservoir Dogs, but I was very small and I wanted to be in it. Anyway, that's what made me
amazing. Think it's like tree number three that I've also been. I remember being in like a musical production of Calamity Jane in high school, but at that time they wanted to do my makeup, but I was like really like a control freak, and I'm like, and also hyper fixated on blue eyeliner. So it's like there's like Western production where people are meant to be like in cowboy boots and brown clothes, and I'm like, nobody would touch my face, and I went and put on the biggest like blue winged eyeliner, which did not go with the ensemble cast, but I was like one of the very secondary characters, but I'm like, I will stand out in Calamity Jane.
A main character is a main character.
Yeah. Absolutely. What to do.
Okay,
well, thank you so much. And for more fun bits like this interview, you have you have your show The Wheel at Melbourne International Comedy Festival on now from now, 7th of April to the 19th of April at The Greek at 168 Lonsdale Street. And we'll have links to our podcast show notes and our Instagram on how to buy tickets. But is there anything else you want to leave us with before you go, Demi?
I don't think so. I'm so happy to be here. There's so many other good shows during the festival that I would recommend you see. My friend Elf Lyons is doing two shows that are both phenomenal. My friend Frankie McNair has got the show that is terrific. My friend Jeremiah Ditto. It's all these people that I've met in my travels and doing other festivals that I'm like, oh, I'm so excited I get to perform again with them at a festival. And yeah, I recommend you go see them all.
Yeah, amazing. Yes, we'll have links to the special and the show. But thanks so much, David, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
I want to drop food, not bombs. Hot trains, volunteer at every info shop. I want to give free therapy out in the park. Go to free school, jump to top track.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favorite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:01 in the morning, and we are now joined by Dr. Alastair Sisson, Macquarie University-based housing researcher and urban geographer, who is speaking with us about a range of housing policy concerns, including the impact of supply chain disruptions on residential construction and calls for tax reform in the lead-up to this year's federal budget. Alastair is a Macquarie University Research Fellow whose work focuses on housing, planning and urban development. Good morning, Al.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. There's a lot to talk about in the housing policy landscape at the moment, and I thought it might be a good time to take stock since we're leading up to the federal budget, but there also have been significant alarms sounded around the already ailing construction industry and its impact on housing supply. Now, housing stress is predicted to worsen across Australia, exacerbated by supply chain disruptions caused by the US-Israeli war on Iran. Can you break some of this down, given that the federal Labor government has strongly emphasized supply-side fixes to housing affordability and availability?
Yeah, so it's probably worth starting by saying that the outlook for housing supply or for construction even before the war on Iran was fairly weak. Many listeners will have heard of the National Housing Accord, which was the Albanese government's target of 1.2 million new homes by 2029, negotiated with state and territory governments. So before the war last year, they were set to fall short of that target by close to 400,000 homes when you factor in the homes that would be lost due to demolition. So they were, the government was falling behind on its supply target already. The war, if it causes, well, it has already caused supply chain disruptions and increased costs to materials and fuel, that's likely to make that situation worse. So one of the ways it'll do so is through the price of construction materials and for fuel, and various petroleum-based products. Those costs rose, in the past by about 40% from 2020 to 2024 due to the pandemic and war in Ukraine. That might be something that we see more of in the years to come. And then the other factor that might weigh on housing supply is interest rates. So if the Reserve Bank of Australia decides that inflation is running too hot, mainly due to the cost of fuel and petroleum-based products, then it will increase interest rates from their current level of 4.1%. That obviously has an impact on households with mortgages, which we can talk about later, but it also means that it becomes more expensive for private property developers to obtain finance, so to borrow the funds that they need to build from banks and other lenders, and therefore more expensive to build and fewer homes are built. So, the outlook, which was already not very positive, is probably going to get bleaker.
Fantastic. And this is, something that seems, it seems frustrating that we're at this point. You and I are both housing researchers. We've been analyzing this landscape for a while and have drawn attention to the supply side emphasis as,
you know, something that is really not capable of holistically addressing housing crisis and housing affordability and availability here. Now, what effects could the supply side squeeze have on the material conditions of tenants and, as you've previously mentioned, mortgage holders who are currently in housing stress?
So we can break that into, like you say, and you know, we're in a situation where we already have very low vacancy rates in the private rental sector, which means it's very competitive, and that's going to remain the case, you know, for the foreseeable future, I think. Even if this war hadn't happened, it's not as though there was about to be a whole lot of new housing completed in the next few months or the next year that would significantly reduce pressure on rent. So I suppose the situation is to some extent, the same, albeit maybe a little bit worse. For people with mortgages, as I mentioned, if there's another increase in interest rates, then that will be passed on to households with mortgages. The situation is currently, or as of last year, was that more than half of households with mortgages in the first two income quintiles spend more than 30% of their income on their mortgage. So that's households below median wage who we might say are in housing stress. If you add the households who are earning around the median wage mark, it's still more than half of households with mortgages who are in stress. And so those rates, you know, they rose pretty dramatically due to interest rate rises in 2022 and 2023, and so we could see further rises if there's a further round of interest rate rises in the months to come.
Yeah.
And I guess in terms of the material conditions, you know, what that means is people cutting back or completely foregoing essentials and living in worse quality or unsafe housing, some people losing their homes, potentially becoming homeless. And I think maybe especially important to point out is, you know, that it can cause an even tighter squeeze at the lowest end of the private rental market, you know, with relatively higher income households looking to save money by moving into slightly cheaper rentals. And that's something that's been happening over the last few decades already, but it could also be exacerbated by these trends.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we're seeing this combined with, you know, sustained divestment from public housing and with, you know, quite a nebulous affordable housing sector that still, you know, it hasn't really gotten off the ground at a scale that would suggest it's able to alleviate some of these pressures for people that are struggling at the, you know, lowest income end of the rental sector. Now, there has been also some talk about Australia heading towards a recession, and you've mentioned interest rates already rising and increasing mortgage stress. They're also predicted to continue rising over the next few months. So can you talk about and maybe explain a bit more about how those interest rates interact with cost of living pressures?
Yeah, so I mean, the recession, if there is a recession, then we're likely looking at rising unemployment, right, as you know, firms reduce their level of investment. Rising unemployment means lower incomes, and that's the other side of the housing stress equation, right? So, you know, we focus a lot on housing costs, and rightly so, and how they've been rising over the last few years. But the other side of it is that wages are relatively stagnant, you know, in an economy of you know, increasingly insecure work. A recession is only going to make that worse. If businesses start laying off workers, that'll throw a lot of people into financial stress, and you know, could mean quite a steep deterioration in housing affordability, and financial stress and poverty more broadly.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, on top of this, where I guess we're also seeing a broader shift in some of the, you know, political narratives around tax measures that have been known to exacerbate housing crisis. Now, last month, the there was a Senate inquiry report handed down into the effects of the capital gains tax. And as we head towards the federal budget, investors are already panicking about the impacts that potential changes to capital gains tax concessions and negative gearing are going to have. And again, this is the question of, you know, those supply side measures and concerns about profit margins. Can you talk about what we're seeing in the tax reform space, both, you know, the Albanese government's appetite to introduce reforms and then, you know, concerns raised by various sectors and the impacts that those reforms could have?
Yeah, I have to say I'm fairly skeptical of the claims that these reforms will lead to a significant disinvestment. You know, that's those are claims that have been made in the past by the property industry and real estate institutes and the like around stricter tenancy laws, you know, ending no-grounds evictions and that sort of thing. And we haven't really seen that disinvestment occur. So I think that, you know, it would definitely be a positive thing if these tax reforms are introduced. And, you know, if negative gearing was abolished and the capital gains tax concessions also abolished, then that could be close to $20 billion of revenue raised by the Commonwealth government that could be spent on things like public housing and higher social security payments and that sort of thing. So I think that it is a positive. And I guess the other point to make as well, is even if there is a reduction in investment by landlords, well, that probably means that there's less competition for first home buyers and therefore slightly cheaper house prices at the kind of the home buyer price point.
I do want to, you know, tie this conversation off talking about, again, those supply side versus demand side policy prescriptions and, you know, what the effect has been over the short, medium, long term of really emphasizing supply and what we might do differently to actually alleviate, you know, the everyday experiences of housing stress and affordability that so many of our listeners, but just so many people across the country in general are facing.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about focusing on housing supply is that it takes a long time to build new homes, right? And so if we're talking about a housing crisis, we're talking about something that is short-term in nature, or, you know, a crisis that needs a sort of immediate response. And that's not something that can be achieved really by just focusing on building housing. So we do need to think about what we're doing in the kind of immediate term as well, and what are the things that would have a very positive impact for renters would be rent control. So capping rent increases like they do in many places around the world, many US states and municipalities, many nations in Europe and other places limit rent increases for private renters. We can also talk about, you know, the utilization of existing housing stock. You know, so there are a lot of larger homes that are underutilized by their occupants, they have, you know, vacant bedrooms and that sort of thing. And we can think about ways to, I guess, incentivize or encourage people downsizing. There have been some moves in states like WA and South Australia to provide kind of tax incentives or, you know, like, for example, stamp duty concessions or waivers for people downsizing into a new apartment. But there are probably other, I guess, sticks rather than just carrots that can be used. Things like a progressive land tax, even a vacant bedroom tax, which is something seriously that was floated by the property data firm Totality at the Commonwealth Government Productivity Roundtable last year. To, you know, really start to think about how do we maximize, how do we more effectively utilize the existing housing that we have. And then maybe just for thinking about households who are in mortgage stress as well, the geographer Danny Dorling has this quite interesting idea of a right to sell, where, you know, financially stressed mortgage holders can sell their home to the government and it becomes public housing and therefore adds to the public housing stock, adds revenue to the public housing system and provides those households with greater security. So I think those are the kinds of things that we need to be thinking about in addition to, you know, tax reform, which is a positive development, and, yeah, increasing housing supply.
Yeah, thank you so much, Al, for breaking this down. I mean, it is always worth taking a temperature check as we head into the frantic budget season. And, you know, I think taking stock of some of the key conversations that are happening at the moment is really helpful, because we are going to see some shifts in policy. We're going to need to be able to interpret what various different actors are lobbying for in terms of, you know, what happens in the budget and how policy measures are put in place that will have to, you know, that will inadvertently impact the housing market, but may not immediately look like they will in relation to supply chain disruptions around the war on Iran. So, yeah, really appreciate your time this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And that was Dr. Alastair Sisson, Macquarie University-based housing researcher and urban geographer, speaking with us about a range of housing policy concerns, including the impact of supply chain disruptions on residential construction, calls for tax reform in the lead up to this year's federal budget, and the perennial issue of balancing supply side and demand side policy measures in the housing question. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Quando sono solo in casa e solo devo restare.
Benvenuti, benvenuti al programma Radio Filet.
Mercoledì pomeriggio dalle 18:30 alle 19:30.
And for those who don't speak Italian, that's Wednesday evening, 6:30 to 7:30 p.m.
You'll hear from multi-generational Italian voices coming together to connect and learn and discuss Italian culture.
And politics.
And politics.
Radio File, building bridges between the diaspora.
The program will be part in Italian, part in English, so
practice your Italian or hone your listening skills.
Radio File, la voce alternativa della comunità italiana a Melbourne.
Tune in to 3CR 855 AM, or you can listen online, 3cr.org.au.
Radio File.
You're tuned in to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is just coming up to 8:17 in the morning, and we're joined for our final interview by Australian Unemployed Workers Union member and co-presenter of 3CR's Breadline show, Jessica Harrison. And Jessica is speaking with us about the ongoing fight to abolish work for the dole leading up to the 10th anniversary of the death of Josh Park Fing in April 2016. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
Thank you for joining us today. Now, can we begin just with a bit of a reminder about Josh Park Fing's story and his tragic passing 10 years ago at a Work for the Dole site at the Toowoomba Showgrounds?
Yeah, first of all, we'd like to extend our sympathy to his family because his death was completely unnecessary and just very tragic. So what happened was he was on a Work for the Dole site in Toowoomba, and he was tasked with the job of collecting rubbish bins from the site, which was done by loading them onto the tray back of a trailer, which was towed by a tractor. So he'd already alerted his family to the fact that he didn't feel safe on the site because of the health and safety issues. And very sadly, that day he had even rung his dad and said that. But he was thrown from the trailer and had head injuries, which caused his death. Yes, so he was just expected to sort of cling on to the back of the trailer. And again, completely crazy, completely wrong, completely lacking in any health and safety.
Yeah, it's just awful and so negligent. And I understand he'd also reported a back injury at the same site previously.
That's so, right. Yeah. He was concerned about that and he wanted to get out of the program. But of course, as we know, the way the poverty machine works, if you left at Work for the Dole site, your payments would be suspended or cancelled.
Mm. Yeah. And that coercion is really just so, so pervasive. Now, 10 years on from Josh's death, have the health and safety and, you know, insurance and training concerns that led to this tragedy been really addressed in any systematic sense by the Commonwealth government?
No, they haven't been. I mean, his job service provider was fined $90,000 a couple of years after his death. But we know that the percentage of these of workplace incidents in these Work for the Doll sites is high, and when the unions have spoken out about it at the time, and it shouldn't be up to the Work for the Doll victim to sort of raise these issues with, you know, again, the media or with unions and so on. I mean, it's, and the other thing that really stirs us up in the union is the fact that a lot of young people, anyone under 30 who's expected to do 25 hours a week work for the Doll, isn't ever told that they could do alternative activities like training, study or voluntary activities. They're just forced into this, which ultimately benefits these private companies, which are able to sort of get almost completely cheap labour.
It is really concerning to hear that there hasn't been an effort to really address this properly. And that leads me to ask, how is Work for the Doll regulated? What concerns do you have about the way that the program operates?
Well, it's operated in a very haphazard manner. I mean, one of the biggest users of the Work for the Doll system is the Salvation Army, who operate a large number of sites. We also have Vinnies and Lifeline. It's not regulated in a proper way, I think probably us and the Anti-Poverty Centre are the only ones keeping track of incidents in these places. But I certainly know that its purported aim, which is to sort of help people get jobs, is not being achieved. And you know, we really are calling for it to be abolished because it's been shown to be incompetent.
And also
risky.
Yes, yeah. Of course. I mean, you speak to the labour that the AEWU and Anti-Poverty Centre are doing to maintain a sense of independent oversight. But apart from that, am I correct in understanding that oversight of the program is, you know, by Workforce Australia and not necessarily something that's transparently reported to people?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. In fact, they've refused to announce the stats of numbers of workplace incidents in Work for the Doll site.
Yeah, extremely concerning. Now, I wanted to link this into the program's philosophy overall and to ask you, you know, what's wrong with this phrasing work-like that is used, that is applied to Work for the Doll activities, and how does this sort of punitive workfare regime undermine the dignity of people that access social security payments?
Well, where can you start, really? I mean, the whole way that it's introduced, which is when we know this from people who have actually tried to get work in some of these private job network providers, is that they're told, well, we're not here to give you a job, to get people jobs. We're here, give them 6 months, they'll get themselves a job, or else they get put on Work for the Doll or some other compulsory scheme. So it's really a sort of a sham of a system where the privatised networks cream off money from the government and from us ultimately, and then they use that to punish the people who are most at risk. And I wanted to mention as well, a lot of talk at the moment about the cost of living crisis, but people on Work for the Doll are given $20 a fortnight to cover their transport costs. So that's another outrage, really. Anyone from 18 to 60 can be forced into the system. And, yeah, I mean, the unions have spoken out against them. I would love there to be more union activity on that, the safety aspect, but also the punitive and the compulsory nature of it, and the fact that it does undermine paid jobs.
Yeah.
I mean,
go ahead.
Yeah, and the other thing that sort of enrages me is the sort of well-meaning types who say, "Oh, well, it's helping people do training, helping people get a job." They sort of have this illusion that the privatized job networks actually are there to help people. We know they're not.
Yeah, I mean, it's become an entire beast, this the privatized job network provider system. It is, you know, it relies, I guess, on the denigration of people accessing Social Security payments and the assumption that, you know, people need to be
need to be forced to do particular activities, that they don't have any agency, inherent motivation, anything like that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's really a way of sort of belittling and putting people down, and also sort of undermining their confidence in themselves to be able to have to jump through these hoops, which I see as the sort of modern equivalent of sort of digging a hole. You know, we know that the Sasso program in the Depression was very much tied up with trying to keep people busy and keep them worn out. And the way what people are having to do now to survive, you know, part-time jobs, people who are unwell are forcing themselves to do part-time jobs, or else are forcing themselves to do voluntary work just so they can get the meagre payment, which, as we know, is far below the official poverty line.
Yes, and, you know, it really speaks to the need for some massive systemic change. And I wanted to wrap up by asking about the AUW's gathering that you're holding to commemorate the 10th anniversary of Josh Parkfing's passing on Friday, the 17th of April, from 1 to 2 p.m. outside the office of Andrew Giles, MP, in Thomastown. What are your demands and how can people support?
Well, our primary one is, of course, the abolishing of the work for the dole system. And then tied into that is for the mutual obligation system, as it stands, to be abolished as well. Then we go on to raising the payments to the poverty line. I've been on interviews before. I said I dream of a poverty line. I'm lucky because I'm now on the age pension. But those are our primary demands, but also there's a sort of secondary one which has been supported as well by the CPSU, which is that a non-privatised system which allows people to look for jobs that are actually available, not fake jobs. In other words, bringing back something like the CES, which is not a profit-making system.
So if people want to come through, is there anything that they should know about, anything to bring, about what's going to be happening on the day as well?
Pretty much bring themselves. It's quite handy to Thomastown train station, the office, 187 High Street, Thomastown, so easy to find. We'll have some refreshments there. As far as I can see, it's fairly accessible. So, yeah, bring yourself, but really bring solidarity and bring outrage at the system as it stands.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, thank you so much, Jessica. I really appreciate you making the time this morning.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And that was Jessica Harrison, Australia Unemployed Workers Union member and co-presenter of 3CR's Breadline show, talking about the ongoing fight to abolish work for the dole leading up to the 10th anniversary of the tragic passing of Josh Parkfing in April 2016. Jessica has been active in the AUWU since it was founded, starting the Wonthaggi branch, and is now on the Committee of Management. And you can catch Jessica on Breadline Mondays at 6 p.m. on 3CR 855 AM. And we will have a link in our show notes to register to attend the Justice for Josh 10 Years On gathering on the 17th of April. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast. It is 8:28 in the morning, and we'll give you a quick little rundown of what we talked about today. So just to start off with, we heard from Wiradjuri woman Kelly Flanagan speaking on International Women's Day about the realities of the prison system.
And then we heard from Debbie Adejuwebe about his recent Melbourne International Comedy show on Now called The Wheel.
After that, we were joined by Dr. Alastair Sisson to talk about a range of housing policy concerns, including supply chain disruption impacts and calls for tax reform in the lead up to the federal budget. And as you just heard, finally, we were joined by Jessica Harrison from 3CR's Breadline Show and the AUWU. And we just wanted to remind people that the coronial inquest into the death in custody of Noongar man Geoffrey Wynmar is still going today and tomorrow at the Coroner's Court of Victoria. It ends tomorrow, and the family are asking that people come show up in the courtroom, bring people and share with others to show solidarity. So that is 65 Cavanaugh Street, South Bank, today and tomorrow at 10 a.m.
And we will have links to everything in the show notes, as well as how to buy tickets to Demi's show.
Amazing. And we'll catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast. But for now, stay tuned for Lost in Science. Bye.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.